Welcome to Culturetopia, NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and cultural stories. I am Neda Ulibe. This week on Culturetopia, Leonardo DiCaprio talks about what he admires and what he doesn't about the character he plays in Clint Eastwood's new biopic about J. Edgar Hoover. A look at Spotify, the cloud-based streaming music service. Sure, it's fast, convenient, and legal, but can it turn a profit? And a remembrance of the rapper, Heavy D. But first,
who was J. Edgar Hoover? Well, here's what everyone agrees on. He was the first director of the FBI. He served through 8 presidential administrations and 3 wars. Now, a new film called J. Edgar, starring Leonardo DiCaprio and directed by Clint Eastwood, offers a controversial take on this fiercely private man. The movie's portrayal is clear. J. Edgar Hoover was a closeted homosexual, and his longtime assistant Clyde Tolson was also his gay lover. Hoover bested all his enemies in part because he was ruthless and in part because he had information. Information that made him untouchable.
We spend our lives working for justice, and the thanks we get is a political attack. Do we expect crimes to go unsolved? Why is he fighting me? I want you to start a file on Senator McKellar immediately. I want 4 agents on at all times. I want to know what's in his trash, and I want you to photograph him at every dinner. Don't get in the car. You can walk back.
J. Edgar Hoover is the latest in a series of complicated roles that Leonardo DiCaprio has taken on in recent years. He's shunned the romantic or heroic leads in favor of morally ambiguous and often complex characters. In the case of Hoover, the actor came here to Washington, D.C. to find out all he could about the man, how he worked, how he walked, how he talked, the room where he died. But still, DiCaprio says he feels neither sympathy nor empathy for J. Edgar Hoover.
But I do admire his great dedication to our country, and I do admire the genius that he had in creating a fingerprint system in our country and using modern forensics and restructuring this bureau in a way that was incredibly necessary in our country at that time. It was a much different time than we know of today. I think that if there was sympathy or empathy to have that the audience may have with him, it's in the understanding of his motivations, not necessarily the results.
The film focuses quite a bit on the relationship between Hoover and his assistant, Clyde Tolson, some say his lover. And the script assumes that Hoover was a repressed homosexual. What do you make of that?
Well, you speak to 2 different camps. If you go to the FBI, they are very right in stating there is no evidence of any kind showing that these 2 men had an intimate relationship on any level. And that could very well be the case. J. Edgar Hoover was no priest, but the FBI was his church. And what was paramount to him was making sure that he was at the front and center of the FBI. And he was looked at as a great leader. And anything that would tarnish that image would not be tolerated. So I think what we try to portray here is a very realistic, you know, it's dramatized, of course, but the very realistic portrayal of 2 men that spent the entirety of their lives together, that went on vacation together, that lived together, that ate lunch and dinner together, that went to work together. They had
partnership. Buried next to each other.
Yeah, they're buried next to each other. J. Edgar Hoover left him everything he had. Whatever happened behind closed doors, very tactfully in this film, I don't think we show.
Anyone who sees this film, Leonardo, is going to be amazed at your physical transformation, because for much of the film, you are an old man. Walk us through how they turned you into J. Edgar Hoover in his late 60s.
I originally requested for me to be able to take a little sabbatical and go off to, you know, what did De Niro do? He went off to Italy,
to
or Tuscany,
yourself.
And gorged himself
yeah,
with
right.
pastas and steaks. But that would have been fantastic. Unfortunately, they said, well, the film isn't going to be greenlit if we take a huge break. It's either got to be done this way or no way at all. So I donned a fat suit with a lot of weight. You know, there were over 100 different pieces to put on my face every day,
wow.
2 skull caps, and it was a 6-hour process. We did multiple makeup sessions before the film even started. And thankfully, Clint set up a schedule where we got to have even footing for our characters and do the first month and you know, as the younger characters in the last couple weeks, we got to almost do a separate film, which was all the older section of the movie. So it was like shifting gears and slowing everything down. And slowing your heart rate down at times, but more so than anything, trying to capture what it was like to have 50 years of political experience under your belt. But most of all, the big problem with the makeup is it does become incredibly claustrophobic after a while. You do have to fight the urge to want to rip the makeup off every day because, yeah, I mean, it gives you intense claustrophobia. That's all I have to say.
I want to ask you about the arc of your career because the roles that you've been doing in recent years have been complicated roles, in some cases dark characters. You haven't played the sort of the classic romantic lead. Talk to me about the kinds of roles you're attracted to right now.
I don't know. I look at it this way. I'm in a very fortunate position in my life right now, and I've been working, for over 20 years, and I'm getting to do the roles that I want to do. And I've never really questioned why I gravitate towards certain characters. I suppose it's the belief that I can be of service to those characters and that there's a lot of different complications to them on an emotional level, and that's always intriguing to me.
Is there a film that influenced you more than any other?
I suppose seeing East of Eden at a very young age really knocked the wind out of me. I remember watching... I just like the whole story of, you know, how of James Dean at that time, in the sense that Brando was the new method guy in town, and he everyone was trying to be like him, and Kazan chose James Dean for the role of in East of Eden, and I suppose there was something about that performance, the incredible vulnerability that Dean had at that age, and how powerful some of those sequences were with his father that just blew me away. And That was the one that I remember seeing. That and, of course, Taxi Driver. That to me is still the greatest independent film of all time. And I'd never – it was the first time I remember feeling truly embarrassed for a character when he took her out to the porno theater on his first date. I remember, you know, having to hide from the screen that I was so embarrassed for Travis Bickle, and how he tricked you, you know, on a psychological level. I was with him completely, understood his motives, and all of a sudden he's making a homemade, you know, assassination device for a senator, and you go, wait a minute, this character has betrayed me.
Did you ever talk to De Niro about his role? Did you ever say any of that to him?
I suppose I did at that age. I had all kinds of questions for him when we were doing This Boy's Life, but He was incredible to watch at 16, you know, to have come from television and commercials and watch the dedication of Robert De Niro on set and see how he physically transformed himself, how he created his characters, and just the respect level that he had on set from everybody, and how he played with his character and you know, the improvising that he did with me just forever shaped my idea of what acting is, and he's still to this day my favorite.
That's Leonardo DiCaprio. He stars in the new film, J. Edgar. It's about the life of FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover. Leonardo DiCaprio, thank you so much.
Thank you.
A big event in the American art world is happening this Friday in a small city in Arkansas. It's the opening of Crystal Bridges in Bentonville, Arkansas, a museum funded by Walmart heiress Alice Walton. It might not be as large as the Metropolitan in New York or the National Gallery in Washington, D.C., but critics say it will be one of the best collections of American art in the world. NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports that Crystal Bridges is often referred to as the Walmart Museum, even though the corporation has little to do with it.
If you're looking for an actual Walmart museum, the closest you're going to get is the Walmart Gallery in the Walmart Visitor Center in Bentonville. More than 11,000 people work at the company's headquarters here, but Bentonville is not exactly a thriving metropolis. There's a small town square, the rest pretty much strip malls and hotels.
Looks like Walton's truck.
Monica Divis and her mother Rita are sitting outside a restaurant on the square. Monica has worked for Walmart for 22 years. She says people from around the world come here to do business with Walmart.
If you sit out here long enough, you're going to hear several languages spoken around here. We were just in the visitor center, and there was a lady from China buying things to take back because we have Walmart in China. There's Walmart in Japan. So it is becoming an international destination, if you will.
But when it comes to the arts, there hasn't been much, says Rita Divis.
In this part of the world, we need that desperately.
Alice Walton agrees. With the Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art, Walton has said she wants to tell the story of America through art. And walking through the museum is like taking a tour, not just of great art, but of American history and culture. There are famous portraits of George Washington, 19th century works by Thomas Aikens and John Singer Sargent, an eye-popping abstract piece from African-American artist Romer Bearden, and Andy Warhol's Dolly Parton.
So the continuation of the 19th century from the mid-century, the Civil War moment beyond.
On a recent press preview of Crystal Bridges, director Don Bacigalupi showed off the galleries and classrooms.
One of which is what we call the Experience Studio. So it's a kind of drop-in place for children and families to try their hand at things. So if they get excited by watercolor, they can go and take a watercolor class next door or whatever it is.
From the outside, the museum building itself is a work of art. With its curved copper roof, it looks almost like an enormous creature nestled in the woods. It was designed by Moshe Safdie.
It's a rugged landscape. We're harnessing nature here. And the idea is to experience art with nature together.
Safdie is the same architect who did the Skirball Center in Los Angeles and the new Kauffman Center in Kansas City. The grounds have 3.5 miles of walking and biking trails. The museum staff is hoping nature will lure people who might not otherwise be interested in art. Don Bacigalupi.
I think the museum is richly accessible to a whole range of audience members, potential audience members.
The massive undertaking, the collection, the building, the trails, has been bankrolled by, among others, the Walton Family Foundation. They gave $1.2 billion for an endowment. That's billion. The Walmart Foundation gave $20 million so that admission to Crystal Bridges could be free. But not everyone who works for Walmart is excited about it.
My name is Jerome Allen. I'm from store 5312, Fort Worth, Texas.
It was purely coincidence, but a day before the museum press preview, Jerome Allen and about 150 other Walmart workers from around the country also went to Bentonville for completely different reasons.
We're not getting the respect that we deserve as employees.
Jerome Allen says he had not heard of the art museum, but he says he'll be back because they didn't get the meeting they wanted with Walmart CEO Mike Duke.
When I return, because we will return, and I might stop into the art museum.
But for Ernest Davis, that's out of the question. He works at a Walmart-owned Sam's Club in St. Louis, Missouri.
I have no interest in a museum because it might be full of lies.
Will that kind of distrust of Walmart spill over to the museum? The Crystal Bridges staff insists there is no connection between the two.
I don't feel aligned with the corporation at all.
Don Bacigalupi says no one at Walmart is involved in the museum's daily operations, and Alice Walton invested her own money to build Crystal Bridges. Of course, her fortune is built on Walmart stock. Lorraine Milot is a writer for the French newspaper Libération.
Even if it's not called a Walmart museum, it is Walmart's money.
Milot was also on the recent press tour in Bentonville.
It's a very nice museum. It's a place of pure beauty. It's just the very opposite of everything what Walmart is doing. Its focus of the museum is on American art, whereas Walmart stores focus on cheap imports from China.
Now, throughout history, wealthy arts patrons have helped build cultural institutions. Andrew Carnegie, Henry Clay Frick, more recently Eli Broad. Before coming to Crystal Bridges, Kevin Murphy was a curator at the Huntington Library, Art Collections, and Botanical Gardens in California.
I mean, do people not go to the Huntington because Henry Huntington was a railroad baron and, you know, was discriminatory in his practices and treated workers unfairly? I mean, I don't think people don't go to those museums because the robber barons of the Gilded Age were associated with some pretty, what one might have said were unfair practices.
Maybe not. But to get to Crystal Bridges, people will still have to go to Bentonville, Arkansas. Will the trip be worth their while? There is an airport, which Alice Walton also helped build. There are other things to do, like hiking in the Ozarks, or a side trip to the 19th century town Eureka Springs, and a visit to the real Walmart gallery, which includes Sam Walton's pickup truck. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
Americans have been wrestling with some big political issues, and at times like this, some lean on the big ideas of famous political and economic thinkers.
Today we start a series of reports on big thinkers of the past whose acolytes hope they will shape the future. These are people whose ideas turn up constantly in the news, even if you don't always hear their names.
They are people like the economist Friedrich Hayek and John Maynard Keynes.
And then there's a writer of fiction whose admirers want to make her ideas real. Her name was Ayn Rand. NPR's Andrea Seabrook has the story.
Ayn Rand is best known for her novels, The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. The ideas behind them, her philosophy, have sunk so deeply into our political thought, most people don't even recognize them as her ideas anymore. But Rand does have important admirers. Republican budget chairman Paul Ryan, former Fed chief Alan Greenspan, and recently House Speaker John Boehner channeled Rand when he said,
"Job creators in America basically are on strike."
Underpinning that statement is a philosophy Rand introduced through her best-selling novel, Atlas Shrugged. Ironically, when it was first released in the late 1950s, it wasn't exactly embraced.
Throughout the United States, small pockets of intellectuals have become involved in a new and unusual philosophy which would seem to strike at the very roots of our society.
CBS News journalist Mike Wallace interviewed Rand years before he first appeared on the program 60 Minutes. It's 1959. Wallace is in a chair on a stark set, holding his notes and a cigarette. Across from him, Ayn Rand, a native Russian, small and sharp, a little nervous. Wallace asks her to outline the ideas she calls objectivism. It is, she says, a system of morality.
A morality not based on faith.
On faith.
Not on faith, not on arbitrary whim, not on emotion, not on arbitrary edict, but on reason. A morality which can be proved by means of logic.
Rand wholly rejected religion. She called it a weakness, even a parasite, one that convinces people their purpose is to work for the betterment of others. In fact, she says, for man, the truth is just the opposite.
That his highest moral purpose is the achievement of his own happiness.
The achievement of his own happiness. Wallace asks her, how does this apply to politics, to government? And this is interesting. Listen to the journalist's assumptions about the America of that time. Eisenhower in the White House, Leave It to Beaver on the TV.
Now, one of the principal achievements of this country in the past 20 years particularly, I think most people agree, is the gradual growth of social protective legislation based on the principle that we are our brother's keepers.
Welfare, social security, fair labor standards, public health programs.
How do you feel about the political trends of the United States?
I feel that it is terrible, that you see destruction all around you, and that you are moving toward disaster until and unless all those welfare state conceptions have been reversed and rejected.
These programs are destroying individual liberties, Rand says, especially the freedom of producers, entrepreneurs, businessmen. The government has no right to take their property, she says.
I imagine that you're talking now about taxes.
Yes, I am.
And you believe that there should be no right by the government to tax. You believe that there should be no such thing as unemployment compensation, regulation during times of stress.
That's right. I'm opposed to all forms of control. I am for an absolute, laissez-faire, free, unregulated economy.
By now, these ideas should sound familiar. At the time, Rand's novels were almost universally panned. Her ideas were called the height of immorality. Her followers, the objectivists, were seen as a radical sideshow in politics and economics. But now?
Every time you submit to a regulation, it diminishes your liberty.
Iowa Republican Congressman Steve King loves Rand, he says, speaking just off the House floor a few weeks ago. Freshman Republican Congressman Mick Mulvaney of South Carolina has read Rand's novels 6 or 8 times each.
It's almost frightening how accurate a prediction of the future the book was.
In Atlas Shrugged, what Rand considered her masterpiece, the wealthy corporate producers are the engines of the American economy, but they're constantly stymied by invasive legislation and terrible government regulations. That's exactly what Florida Republican Ellen West sees happening in America today. And he says it's very dangerous.
Because if you start to demonize a certain segment of your society that are the producers, eventually they'll stop.
That's just what they did in Rand's novel, Atlas Shrugged. Her wealthy heroes go into hiding, leaving behind the welfare class, what Rand calls the moochers, and the government, or the looters. Put in today's language,
job creators in America basically are on strike.
This idea, House Speaker Boehner put forth in a recent speech before the Economic Club of Washington, D.C., could have come straight from Atlas Shrugged. Businesses, Boehner said, need to be set free. Instead,
and they've been antagonized by a government that favors bureaucrats over market-based solutions. They've been demoralized by a government that causes despair when what we really need is to provide reassurance and inspire hope in our economy.
Boehner uses the language of slavery when he says we need to liberate our economy from the shackles of Washington. Back in 1959, interviewer Mike Wallace asked Rand, if her ideas are so right, why hadn't Americans, in their democracy, voted to protect the all-important producer class? Her answer? Because the people hadn't been given that choice.
Both parties today are for socialism, in effect, for controls, and there is no party. There are no voices to offer an actual pro-capitalist, laissez-faire, economic freedom and individualism. That is what this country needs today.
If Ayn Rand were alive today, she might be pleased to see that more and more Americans do have that choice. And her ideas are alive and well represented in the United States Capitol. Andrea Seabrook, NPR News, Washington.
And tomorrow our series continues with a look at the Austrian economist Friedrich Hayek, whose free market advocacy influences the outlook of many conservatives today.
And he has cachet. Ron Paul and Rick Perry have mentioned him on the campaign trail. Glenn Beck did a one-hour special devoted to Hayek's book, The Road to Serfdom.
And freshman Republican Congressman Justin Amash from Michigan has a huge portrait of Hayek hung in his office.
And then I also have the signature of F.A. Hayek. And I have that framed.
If you've ever tried to listen to music on a website, you've probably had the experience of waiting and waiting for a song to start. Well, the music service Spotify thinks it's found a way to get music to your computer faster. As NPR's Joel Rose reports, Spotify employs some of the same technology the music industry has been fighting for years.
To give you a sense of how Spotify works, let's pick a song that I don't have on my computer. Say, Roadrunner by Jonathan Richman and the Modern Lovers. Search, click, and...
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6...
There's no wait for buffering or downloading. Spotify feels, in a word, instant.
We're set up so that we can deliver the music with a mean time average of 285 milliseconds, which is, like, super fast.
John Pavley is Spotify's VP of Engineering. That number he mentioned, 285 milliseconds, may sound arbitrary, but Charlie Hellman, Director of Product Development for Spotify, says it's not.
The human perception of instant, it's something like 250 milliseconds. By bringing the time to play on our service down to about 285 milliseconds, the perception is that you already have the file on your computer, that it's instant.
Spotify launched in Europe 3 years ago and in the U.S. this past August. The basic idea behind the company isn't brand new. Music streaming services, where you pay a monthly fee for access to zillions of songs, have been around for a decade. They've never broken through to a mass market. But Elliot Van Buskirk, who writes about music technology for Wired and Evolver.fm, says Spotify might.
To an extent, Spotify is basically like other services that we've had. But the difference is that it has, I think, reduced the friction for people trying this stuff out. And that was one of the first things that I noticed, is that it's just impossibly fast.
Spotify hopes to use that speed to lure consumers to the free advertising-supported version of its service, then convince them to pay a monthly fee to use Spotify on their phones and mobile devices. Its target audience is the millions of people who continue to download music for free from peer-to-peer networks. Ken Parks is the head of Spotify's New York office.
The problem with the environment when Spotify launched the service over 3 years ago is that the illegal alternatives were better, simply better than the legal ones.
So Spotify borrows a few tricks from the peer-to-peer networks it's trying to put out of business. Instead of only downloading a single song file from its own server, Spotify searches for copies of the song wherever it can find them, including the computers of other Spotify users.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
John Pavley says it takes bits of the song from multiple sources simultaneously. And then puts them back together on your computer a lot faster than it could by downloading that single file.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Behind the scenes, while the music is playing, we're grabbing it from wherever we can. You can't interact with the P2P network. It's just a little facility that we use to move things along very quickly.
Before he came to Spotify, Pavley was actually VP of engineering for LimeWire, a popular peer-to-peer network. Unlike the P2Ps it's trying to replace, Spotify actually has licensing deals with the major record labels, and the company announced a deal with Facebook. Elliot Van Buskirk says that allows Facebook users to automatically share the songs they're listening to via Spotify.
It gets closer and closer to that original Napster feeling of, you know, what do my friends have? Can I have that? And now it's like, well, yes, you can. And there's this whole mechanism for finding out what they have that you're already using anyway to share pictures of your cat or whatever it is.
But Van Buskirk says Spotify's deals with the major record labels didn't come cheap. Spotify says it has more than 2 million paying users worldwide, although the company declined to discuss how many of them are in the U.S. Van Buskirk and others think Spotify will have to sign up a lot more if it's going to make a profit. Joel Rose, NPR News, New York.
No doubt, lots of Spotify playlists were set up in tribute yesterday to this man.
Love is a legend. Me, I'm legendary at it. Flipping on the mic makes me a rapping acrobat. Don't try to swing because you couldn't even hang. We got our own thing.
That's rapper Heavy D. He died yesterday at the age of 44. He called himself the Overweight Lover MC. And Heavy D was one of hip-hop's most popular and influential acts in the late 1980s. In early 1990s. He was the frontman for the group Heavy D and the Boys, and he was known for his moves, his music, and his magnetic personality. Adam Bradley is the author of the book The Anthology of Rap, and he joins me now to talk more about Heavy D's place in hip-hop history. Adam, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Guy.
Talk about what Heavy D was doing in rap that made him different and fresh at the time he started in the 80s.
Well, you've got to think about this moment in the late 1980s and the early 1990s when Heavy D emerged. We have on one coast NWA with gangster rap emerging. We have on the other coast Public Enemy with a sort of political consciousness. And with Heavy D, what you had was a sense of musicality, a sense of the party, a sense of the fun that was always a part of hip hop. He really brought the party back to hip hop. He brought dance back to hip hop.
His biggest hit was probably the song Now That We Found Love. So, Adam, I mean, he was basically one of the first people to merge hip-hop and R&B pretty seamlessly, right?
He did. I mean, here we have him moving from hip-hop to R&B. Just at the same moment, you have R&B acts like Jodeci and singers like Mary J. Blige reaching out to hip-hop. And the meeting in between is what created the pop phenomenon of hip-hop. And with the record we just heard, Now That We Found Love, that's really a pop record more than anything else. It has elements that will be recognizable in hip-hop, the strong beat, the syncopated flows. But it's really a record that's inflected with R&B and intended for a pop audience, and that's what Heavy D at his best could do.
And we're not talking about, I mean, let's face it, the most profound lyricist in hip-hop. I mean, he wasn't Chuck D from Public Enemy or even Tupac, but he never tried to be. I mean, he didn't pretend to be something else, right?
No, what he was a lover man, the overweight lover, Evie D, as he called himself. He was somebody who had fun on the microphone, and you could always hear it, the kind of tongue-twisting delivery, the fact that even when he was rapping fast, he sounded like he was laid back.
Where do you see his influence today?
First of all, you have his direct influence in the records that he's produced for artists as diverse as Michael Jackson, Jay-Z, Ziggy Marley, and hosts of others. But you also have his more underground influence, the way that he opened up hip-hop to include a broader range of themes, to celebrate the fun and the party that's always been a part of hip-hop culture. He brought that to the fore, celebrated it, and made it into a platinum hit.
That's Adam Bradley. He's the author of the anthology of rap, remembering the rapper Heavy D, who died yesterday at the age of 44. Adam, thanks.
It's my pleasure, guys.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. Culturetopia is produced by Mike Katziff and executive produced by Sarah Saracen. I am Netta Ulibi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.